a goal from Carlos
Loud and clear.
Moyne will try a long hit. What a goal from Moyne. This is spectacular. It's hit with no regard for humanity. Is this the moment for Shaqiri? Yes, it is! Switzerland! And Shaqiri has scored in the 90th minute. That was worth the price of admission alone.
This is Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
Matt Peterson in for Glenn Davis. Great to be back on Soccer Matters tonight. With you till 9 o'clock, full show. Andrew Carlson, our producer, will be talking Houston Dynamo, Houston Dash, Manchester United, Premier League. Anything you want to talk about, we'll talk about tonight. But we have a great show set up. 7:20. John Arnold, he's based in Dallas. He covers FC Dallas for the Striker Texas. He also covers CONCACAF for his great newsletter, Get CONCACAF. We'll have him look back at the first round of the octagonal, look ahead to the October round of games. That will be at 7:20. And then at 7:40, former Manchester United and England goalkeeper Gary Bailey will come on and talk about this resurgent Manchester United team under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Ronaldo's return, and who should be the number one, David De Gea or Henderson? It's a tough choice. De Gea has been there a long time. Henderson, kind of the heir apparent, anointed by Solskjaer last summer. And the competition is on, and United looks very good. Wild win against West Ham over the weekend. De Gea had a save. Ronaldo had another goal. And a great win in London for Manchester United. Tab Ramos, Houston Dynamo manager, comes on at 8. It's a nice run of form for the Houston Dynamo. They beat FC Dallas 3-2 this weekend. Unbeaten in 3 after the long winless run. Tab Ramos will get his perspective on the win, the 3-game unbeaten streak, also the U.S. men's national team, and the changes that were made at halftime down in Honduras to bring the U.S. back for an emphatic 3-1 win. They get off to a good start in this final round of World Cup qualifying. 8:20 tonight, Diego Bocanegra. He's the head coach of University of Houston. The Cougars off to a great start. Cougar women 8-1-1. They beat Central Florida, who was number 14 in the country last week. They beat Sam Houston on Saturday. They're 1-0 in the American Athletic Conference. Bocanegra's been in charge 5 years, and he'll come on at 8:20 to give an update on his program. A very good team, great attacking talent, depth all across the field, and it's looking really good for Bocanegra University of Houston, which will join the Big 12 in a couple years. Tom Clare, old friend of Glenn Davis, knows Manchester United about as well as anyone. He'll come on at 8:40 to wrap up the show. So an action-packed show, and it's great to have John Arnold on at 7:20 to talk about FC Dallas, the news that Lucci has been dismissed. The first time FC Dallas has let go of a manager mid-season since 2008. A lot of stability up there, but Lucci Gonzalez, who followed Oscar Pereira running the academy at FC Dallas and then came on as head coach, done a great job bringing first-team players up from the academy, but not enough winning. They've been in the playoffs the last 2 seasons. No deep runs, some misses on some DP signings and some high price signings. Not really Lucci's fault, but we'll get perspective from John Arnold on the reason the Hunts let go Lucci Gonzalez and maybe who are some candidates who might take over the Striker Texas. He offered some choices today. Peter Luchin, Josema Bazan, his brother Fabian, Prof Bazan, Dave Vandenberg. We'll get some more choices. And also, what's going on in Dallas? The relevancy of FC Dallas. Was it Lucci's fault that they're kind of sitting mid-table in the West? Now down in the bottom three after Houston beat them 3-2 over the weekend. A lot to talk about with John Arnold. And I think a lot of U.S. men's national team fans and Mexican national team fans will be interested in what John Arnold has to say about the rest of this octagonal, 8 teams in the final round of World Cup qualifying, and it's a deep pool. We'll get Tab Ramos's thoughts on U.S. men's national team in its opening round, but he brings up in the interview, most people figured El Salvador or Jamaica would be the worst team in this final round. If El Salvador is playing to a scoreless draw with the U.S. and Jamaica is giving Mexico a good game, I think it's an indication to everyone that 1 through 8 qualifying will be difficult this time around in CONCACAF. So John Arnold, 7:20. Gary Bailey at 740. Really excited to talk with him. I've called some games with Gary for the NWSL and USL. He was a 10-year starter for Manchester United as a goalkeeper. His last season with Man United was 1986. That's Sir Alex Ferguson's first season. And he'll talk about his favorite goalkeepers around the world, the situation with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, offering idea that David De Gea's job might be up for grabs. Really interesting this week. He saved a penalty against Mark Noble. And then after the game, not a lot of vote of confidence for David De Gea. The heir apparent's Dean Henderson. He's 24 years of age. He started most of Manchester United's final games at the end of last season, 13 total appearances. He's played once for England. He's been part of their U16s, the U21s. He was part of the Euro squad this summer from Gareth Southgate, but had to withdraw due to injury. He got COVID in July. He's come back from that. And David De Gea, inconsistent over the years, at times spectacular, one of the best goalkeepers in the world, at times mistake-prone. So Dean Henderson or Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Henderson is English. He came up through the Manchester United Academy. I'm sure there's a lot of excitement around him and some political push to get him the number one shirt, but De Gea is trying to hang on to it. And he had the big save this weekend for Manchester United. That was a great game if you're able to watch Manchester United and West Ham. Electric atmosphere in London. And a back-and-forth game. Of course, Manchester United coming off a really difficult loss in the Champions League against Young Boys. And Jesse Lingard came off the bench. Brilliant goal, curling it to the upper corner. And I loved his classy celebration. He's scoring against his former team. He went on loan to West Ham last spring, half a season, quite the year he had. 9 goals, 5 assists in 16 games. Hard to be subdued after the goal he scored. And it was the winner. And then some late drama with VAR and the referee, Martin Atkinson. Luke Shaw called for a handball. And very interesting from David Moyes. Mark Noble brought in off the bench, and I'll jump to Andrew right now and get his perspective on this. What did you think of the decision from David Moyes to bring an excellent penalty taker called off the bench in second half stoppage time against De Gea?
Generally speaking, I'm not a fan of that sort of line of thinking. We saw what happened in the Euros with England, obviously. They brought in, you know, Jadon Sancho, among others, to take penalties. Essentially, that was their only responsibility in the final against Italy. And we saw how that turned out. It didn't turn out well. But it's one of those decisions where, if it works out, you know, everyone hails the manager as a genius. He did things right. He put his best penalty taker on the field for that situation, and he delivered. But when he doesn't, it looks, you've got egg on your face. And I think that's what probably happens here. And unfortunately for him, it's a missed opportunity to take what would have been a valuable point out of that game.
I'm with you. I thought the same thing in the Euros. It's one of those where the analytics, I think, go too far, where the data goes too far. Because for me, there's nothing more pressure-packed than coming off the bench for a penalty, especially in a row final. Those guys might be the best in practice, but I felt as a player, and you're watching a game now as a fan, the players on the field, their nerves are down because they're exhausted. So you walk to the penalty spot, that exhaustion, that fatigue is a good thing. If you come in amped up off the bench, especially those young English guys who came off the bench ice cold, it's a tough thing. But I think after the fact, Moyes defended himself well. It's very interesting for West Ham. They've missed 4 of their last 5 penalties. 5 different players have taken a penalty. They've only made 1 of the 5. And in the moment, it looked like Declan Rice wanted to take it. And there was a conversation on the bench where Moyes went to Noble and said, do you want to take this? And he said, I'm ready. So again, we love the substitution rules. I know I do. I don't know about you, Andrew, with 5 subs. But sometimes maybe it's too many options and maybe the managers just gamble too much.
I agree. I think that in this world that we're still living in, I think the expanded 5 subs, the schedules are so hectic nowadays with these players. And I think that it's something that should remain, honestly. I know that for some leagues, they went back to 3 substitutions. And then for some of the stuff in the during the week, the Champions League, they'll do 5 subs. But given how packed these player schedules are, I agree with you. I'm a fan of the 5 subs. But you're right, it does lead to managers overthinking things at times. As a fan of Arsenal, I've seen Mikel Arteta overthink a just whole slew of things over his tenure as Arsenal manager. And for a lot of these guys, the more options they have, it necessarily isn't always better. There are some managers that they're prepared and ready to handle that sort of multitude of choices. Other managers, it's best if you just don't leave them to their own devices for that sort of stuff. And David Moyes, for all of his, you know, positive aspects and what he's done at West Ham. He's done a brilliant job there thus far. I think that may not be one of his strong suits.
Arsenal up to 13th. I know you're pleased. They won again. Mikel Arteta pleased. Which Arsenal is it? Is it the 0-3 team that began with a very difficult schedule or the team that's won two in a row?
It's tough because the team that we saw start the season 0-3, look, they had four positive tests for COVID before their game against Brentford that threw their entire, you know, just preparation out the window. I mean, you're starting a 19-year-old kid at striker instead of, you know, your normal strike force, Alexandre Lacazette, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. And so you lose that game 2-0, a game that you should be winning, but it's a game against a promoted side. And at their place, it's always going to be very difficult, their first game up in the Premier League. And then you play City away and Chelsea at home. Chelsea at home, I would like them to have been more competitive than they were. They didn't look like they belonged on the same pitch. But at the same time, again, you're still dealing with COVID issues. You had maybe five of your first choice 11 out there. I think the team that we've seen the past 2 weeks is closer to the real Arsenal that you're going to see. The question I have is that real Arsenal good enough? And I think that question still has yet to be answered. They still don't always look as potent in attack and in possession as you would like them to, as you would expect an Arsenal team to be. But hopefully, as this young team, extremely young, lots of players under 23 years of age, as they continue to gel, the attack gets better. But this weekend, North London Derby against Tottenham, perfect time to put it all to the test.
At the table is looking a lot more exciting, I think, for neutrals and just fans of the Premier League. Last few seasons, it's been City and Liverpool pulling away early after five games. Chelsea, Liverpool, and United, 13 points each. Brighton and Hove Albion, 1 point back. Nobody saw that coming. There always seems to be one surprise team in the first month or so. They've scored seven. They've conceded only four, and they're 1 point back. And then City and Everton on 10 points. Tottenham struggling a bit on nine. That was a big couple points on the table, as you mentioned, for West Ham. They're in eighth on 8 points after losing a late on the Lingard goal.
Yeah, and West Ham was one of the surprise teams of the season last year. They were fantastic last season, and that's going to be something I'm watching over the course of this entire new campaign is how many of these teams that fared well in that COVID environment with no fans and everything else, because you can say, you know, they had a better away record last year, but what does that really mean? You know, a lot of these teams, when you go away in an atmosphere that you'll face in the Premier League, it's an entirely different beast last year versus what we're going to see this season. We've already seen it multiple times. I mean, look, as speaking again as an Arsenal fan, their away record has been poor for a multitude of years, but last year was better than normal. And you have to think, okay, was that them actually improving in that aspect at all? Or is it just mentally they don't have to deal with the environments that you were facing on the road? So I think that that's going to be something, especially for some of these smaller clubs, that I'm going to be really focusing in on over the course of the season to see if that's a trend that continues from what we saw last year into this next season.
Shifting focus to Major League Soccer, Houston Dynamo wins 3-2. A nice performance from Dorsey Griffin, Griffin Dorsey, Fafapiko, Darwin Quintero again. It was 3-0 Dynamo, two late goals from FC Dallas. And then just the next day, within 48 hours, Luchi Gonzalez is let go. Some momentum for Tab Ramos. They go to Minnesota United this weekend, and we'll get perspective from Tab Ramos at 8 o'clock. On the dash side, it was a really interesting game. Tigres came in, Tigres Femenil on the women's side. It was a Sunday night game. It was head-to-head with Tigres and Monterrey on the men's side, so I think that hurt attendance a little bit. But 5-1 to the dash, great for Houston to get some payback against Tigres after going down to Mexico. And an emotional farewell for Christine Nair, longtime player, excellent pro. And what a cool story, Andrew. She is retiring after one of the most featured players in NWSL history up there is in assists and games and starts. And she is joining the Firefighter Academy in Houston to become a Houston firefighter.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I don't know if you saw the reception she got walking off the field in this final game, but we saw the highlights of it and the hugs and everything else. It was a really cool scene. It was fantastic for her.
Well, we're just getting started. Matt Peterson in for Glenn Davis. A busy show tonight. John Arnold, he writes for The Striker Texas covering FC Dallas. We'll get his reaction to the Luchi Gonzalez news, get his perspective, who might replace him, and the long-term direction of FC Dallas, plus CONCACAF. He is an expert on all things CONCACAF, from the big clubs to the smallest countries, with his great newsletter, Get CONCACAF. Coming up later, Gary Bailey, former Manchester United goalkeeper. We'll get his perspective on the De Gea-Henderson situation. Tab Ramos, 8 o'clock. Diego Bocanegra, head coach of University of Houston Cougar women's soccer. They're 8-1-1 through 10 games, and they beat number 14 Central Florida on Thursday. To round out the show, we'll play Glenn's interview with Tom Clare, the longtime author covering Manchester United. Matt Peterson in for Glenn. This is Soccer Matters. John Arnold joins us after the break.
ESPN 97.5.
Listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
Dallas has won it back. Getting a little bit loose here. O'Brien is going to try to chip it in, and he does. This one will count. This will spoil the shutout. Played out wide. It's O'Brien again. O'Brien will score. It's 3-2. What is going on here?
That's Glenn Davis on the call with Eddie Robinson. Dynamo beat FC Dallas 3-2. And let's talk about our presenting sponsor, the Daspit Law Firm, here on Soccer Matters. John Daspit and his firm are personal injury attorneys. If you get in an accident, car, boat, motorcycle, you might work in a refinery or drive an 18-wheeler. Call the Daspit Law Firm, 713-322-HURT. They're bilingual. They will work for you 24/7, nights and weekends. Get the representation you need with the Daspit Law Firm. My pleasure to welcome to the show, John Arnold. John, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, great to have you. It's a good time to have you on. Dynamo FC Dallas over the weekend, the news of Luchi Gonzalez being let go by FC Dallas. And of course, so much happened around CONCACAF. Let's begin with FC Dallas and the departure of Luchi Gonzalez. You cover this team on a everyday basis with the Striker Texas. How surprised were you with the news?
Well, on the one hand, I think the timing was surprising. You know, FC Dallas has never run themselves in the same manner as a lot of maybe Latin American clubs that, you know, your listeners may also be a fan of, that, you know, if you lose a rivalry game, you're out. FC Dallas had typically had a longer leash with its managers, much more patience, and, you know, that's paid off at times. You know, look at the Oscar Pereja era, winning Supporters Shield in 2016, the Open Cup title as well. They had some rough losses, including to Houston that season. I think it was only the second game of the season they lost 5-0 down at BBVA, and yet they stick with Oscar. Everything goes well. They lift some trophies. But, you know, the way the season has been going for Luchi Gonzalez, you can understand why a move was made. I just was a little surprised they made the move during the season, because Gonzalez was out of contract at the end of the year. FC Dallas had a club option to pick him up. So to me, it probably would have been a more sort of clean process if you just let him see out the last 8 games, do what he can, and then, you know, if you don't think he's up to the standard, which clearly they didn't think he was, let him go at the end of the year. But I think they maybe want to give Marco Ferruzzi, the interim, a bit of a chance and see how he does, if he can start to get some wins, if he can get the team playing a different way. He is a candidate, according to owner Dan Hunt, so maybe they wanted to give him a little audition period, or maybe there's something else at play. But I think it was as surprising as it can be when a team is sitting in 11th place in the Western Conference and just lost to its rival.
Yeah, according to Charles Bohm with MLSsoccer.com, he wrote it's the first time they fired a coach midseason since 2008. So this is not really the FC Dallas MO, a midseason change like this.
No, not at all. I mean, they really have been a club that like I said, has had kind of a long leash. And I think a lot of that goes to the family dynamic around the club. You know, you look at the last several managers. Luchi Gonzalez has just left. Marco Ferruzzi named the interim. Well, he was the assistant for the 4 managers before Gonzalez. Pareja, a guy who they knew as a player and then as an academy coach before he went to the Rapids for a year and came back. Shellis Hindman, who the Hunts knew well from SMU. And even Steve Clark and Steve Morrow and Colin Clark before them. You know, these are guys who are around, who are known quantities. And I think it makes it that much more, you know, difficult to let a guy go when you trust him as much as that. It wasn't an easy decision, I don't think, on Gonzalez either. But like I said, I think that you know, there are other things at play here that made them make this decision. Gonzalez not only head coach for 2.5 years, almost three, but also was with the academy since 2012. I mean, so this is a guy who's been around FC Dallas for almost a decade. So I don't think the move was made lightly, but it is interesting how it came about. And like you said, it's something that FC Dallas doesn't do very often, I think, because of how well they know their personnel that are around the club and how close they keep a lot of things within that sort of brain trust.
So in your opinion, if Gonzalez underachieved this season, was it not getting more out of the homegrown players? They started five this weekend in Houston. Was it not managing the higher-priced players, which I think would be Marco Ferruzzi picked players, and in one case, Dan Hunt, or a combination of both? Do you get a sense that it was one or the other, or maybe just an overall lack of results?
Yeah, I think it's an overall lack of results because, you know, when you look at, did he not get enough out of homegrown players? Well, Ricardo Pepi is the leading scorer, top five, I think, still in MLS. I'm not sure how the goal charts shook out after the weekend. Made his senior national team debut and scored. Well, that's pretty good. You know, you look at some of the players that have come in because of injuries. At fullback, Ima Tomasi, Justin Shea. You know, these are homegrown. Well, Tomasi, a draft pick who's been in the system for a while. Shea, a homegrown who trained with Bayern Munich. You know, they played well. Paxton Pomyko, when he could be healthy, I thought had really positive things. Jesus Ferreira is having a bit of a breakout year at number 10 after we thought he was going to play number 9. You know, he's become a quite good playmaker and is one of the best, I would say, one of the best players under 23 in MLS this year. So I don't think it can be that. Did he not get enough out of the high-dollar guys? Yeah, probably, but I think, you know, in some ways, I feel like that's the hand he was dealt. So I do think, you know, Dan Hunt yesterday said, we did this because we still believe we can make the playoffs. FC Dallas has 8 games left. Every single team above them in the Western Conference has at least one game in hand on FCB. They've played at least one fewer game. And according to a site that crunches the numbers, they have a 2.5 chance of making the postseason. And it's not guaranteed, even if they go 8-0-0, that they make the playoffs. So I do think there's kind of something else at play here, and it's just maybe a sense of overall results, but also maybe a desire to see what Ferruzzi can do.
Yeah, that's a good point. Your article on the Striker of Texas laid that out. And I'd also want to know, what is the goal? The quote from Dan Hunt in the news release announcing the firing was, "We believe a coaching change is in the best interest of the club at the time to help us achieve our goals." They're never really clearly stated for FC Dallas, in my opinion. He got them to the playoffs the last 2 years. It sounds like your goal is to make the playoffs if you're changing your coach midseason just to get into the playoffs.
Well, one of the things that, as someone who's covered this team for a long time and been around it for even longer, you know, living in the Dallas-Fort Worth area since 2001, as I have, Matt, that makes me, you know, sound a little older than maybe I'd like to sound, but I have to own it. You know, being around as long as I have, every single year, Dan Hunt tells the fans, tells the media, and I assume tells the coaches and technical director that the goal is to win MLS Cup. And yet, this team has been in the MLS Cup final once in recent memory. They've won 2 Open Cups and 1 Supporter Shield, but really, when you look at the long history of FC Dallas, one of the original clubs in MLS, the harsh truth for FC Dallas fans is that they really haven't been that close. And if that's the goal, it's just a strange sort of expectation, I think. I think it's quite difficult for a manager to live up to that. You know, I think there is internally maybe an understanding that, well, that's the goal. There's maybe not a great way to achieve that with the cards the manager is being dealt. But if that is the goal, which does seem to be the stated premise every year, I think FC Dallas also really needs to evaluate the way that it operates in the transfer market, not only with the players that they sell, because they make a lot of money off selling these young players and have to do it sometimes mid-season in that summer transfer window. But this year, you know, even a guy like Thiago Santos, who was supposed to be the starting central midfielder for FCD, he's gone a week and a half before the season for, you know, not an incredible transfer fee. He goes back down to Brazil. I think it worked out for him and for his family. Maybe you want to make a guy happy and make it so he's, you know, enjoying his life. There's something to be said for that. But also it put Lucha Gonzalez in a weird situation where suddenly, you know, 10 days before the season, he's trying to figure out who the heck his fix is. So I think that the club really has to evaluate not only when it sells players, but also the players it's bringing in. When Fernando Clavijo, who, you know, sadly passed several years ago, When he was the technical director, he really was kind of a charismatic presence and had many, many contacts in South America. But they haven't really replicated the same types of signings. These guys, Mauro Diaz, Fabian Castillo, you know, a couple other players who were big hits that really worked in MLS. It's been hard for Clavijo and Luis Muzzi, who went to Orlando City, for their predecessors to find the same success, find the same types of players who just work in MLS. Andres Inoza, the current technical director, also has great connections, but I think he's struggled to find the same types of players who just work for whatever reason in MLS. And also what type of player that is has changed in the last 5 years, right? MLS has become a different league. It's become a more challenging league. And I do think that FC Dallas' front office doesn't change many things about the way they operate. It doesn't matter who the coach is, they risk being left behind.
In your article published this afternoon, The Striker Texas, you lay out a few candidates to the job. Technical director Andres Zanotta said yesterday the coaching search was yet to begin. Ferruzzi has positioned himself as a candidate, and his ambition is well known. You lay out a few of these other candidates, Rodriguez, who enjoyed success in Central America. Beyond that, of course, Eric Quill, who is managing North Texas SC in League One, also experienced in MLS. And then you go down the list, Peter Luchin, Josema Bazan and his brother Fabian, known as Prof. Bazan, and Dave Vandenberg. And then one more, I'm getting down the list, Pat Noonan and Jock Passy, bilingual Mexican coach. Among these candidates, do you have any guess on maybe a name or two that might be the front runners?
No, to be honest, I'm throwing darts a little bit, you know, and I even kind of tongue sort of in cheek, but not really, in the start of that article, kind of said, look, you know, this is an article that's fun to write. You know, we love to talk about this on the radio and even when we're just hanging out having dinner. But ultimately, you know, as soon as I know something, it'll go on the Striker Texas. But, you know, right now, Zanotta says, hey, the search hasn't really begun in earnest. And I do think that with Dan Hunt telling, you know, reporters telling us yesterday, hey, Ferruzzi is a candidate. And Ferruzzi today, I asked him, is that your ambition? Do you want to be the head coach of this team in 2022? And he just said yes. I mean, so pretty flat there. I think if it goes well for FC Dallas at the end of the season, you might see Ferruzzi, which I see as a risk because he's never had a head coaching job before. But, you know, he does know the club extremely well, was an assistant under so many different coaches. So I don't know that it's his job to lose. I think there will be a search, but he certainly is. You know, I think this will be an evolving process, is the idea that I have, at least from what the people involved are saying publicly.
John Arnold writes for the Striker Texas and has a great newsletter called Getting CONCACAF. You can subscribe with your email at getconcacaf.substack.com. Let's look back quickly at the World Cup qualifying. It was very exciting. 3 games in about 7 or 8 days. Mexico at the top, Canada, USA, Panama, 2 points back on 5 points. Costa Rica, Honduras, El Salvador, 2 points each, and Jamaica in eighth. Maybe beyond the results themselves, what stood out to you about the opening round of games?
I think that how everyone struggled in a way is what really stood out to me. You know, the formula has always been win at home, draw on the road, and you're good. There's two more teams around this time with the hex expanding to the octagonal. But, you know, I understand U.S. supporters being worried after what happened in 2018 when the U.S. doesn't win their first 2 games, when they don't win at home against Canada. But at the same time, every single team dropped some home points except for Mexico. And, you know, Mexico is doing quite well. They dropped points in Panama. So I think it's easy to think that when you look at the roster of Mexico and the U.S., that those two countries will sort of waltz through qualification. But players will tell you and coaches will tell you and those of us who have been around for a while will tell you it's not that easy, right? So I think that the first window of games is a reminder of that. And even more so with this, you know, weird pandemic-affected qualification cycle that sees 3 games per window for several of these windows, including the first and second. So I think that really tests teams' depth. I think ultimately it does favor teams like Mexico, the United States, teams that maybe have more depth, they can call stronger players from roster slots 18 to 23. But, you know, I really think that the difficulty stood out. Jamaica was disappointing. They were sort of my low light. Mexico and Panama, I think, were the teams that really stood out. U.S. still has a lot to show, but I think they're going to be okay ultimately. I've got Mexico, U.S., Canada projected before, and I'm not changing that after what I saw in the first three matches. I think the North Americans, it's their time, and I think they're going to be able to get those top three slots.
Last one for you. The news of the League's Cup turning into CONCACAF Champions League places beginning in 2023. It's a revamp thing, and you called it the merger for MLS and Liga MX. League's Cup is the merger. Explain that a little deeper and where you think this is going to go.
Yeah, everyone always asks if you know, MLS and Liga MX are going to try and merge. And I've always said, I think they're just going to use League's Cup and just grow it. And now you see it growing to involve every single team. There's a big prize at the end because CONCACAF Champions League can give you, you know, regional glory. And everyone's going to be involved. You know, I think that it gives you the opportunity to see the big games that people want to see, you know, LAFC versus Club America, but also maybe get some depth games in there that, you know, people might want to watch, maybe not. You know, I don't know that everyone's screaming for a Colorado Rapids versus Puebla or something, with all respect to those clubs, but yeah, maybe there will be some entertainment value in that too. Maybe there will be enough games between certain teams if there gets to be sort of rivalries and chippiness. I've said League's Cup is the merger for the last two or three years, Matt, since they've announced the tournament, because I think people have this idea there's going to be a Liga MLS or something like that, and it's just going to be this massive super league. But I think League's Cup is kind of the way that you see the leagues accomplish their goals for this partnership, Mexico being more visible in the U.S., getting more fans in the United States, and earning more American dollars, and MLS being able to prop up a bit their competitive reputation and say, look, okay, we haven't won CONCACAF Champions League yet, but we've beat Mexican teams in League's Cup this many times, or we've done this well when we played Mexican teams in our own stadiums during League's Cup, whatever the case is, and also raising the level, right? So I think those are the things that each side get from benefit. But to me, that the idea of a total and full merger of just smashing them together, I see it as very far off if it is going to happen. But this is pretty close, right? A month of competition between these two leagues with the CONCACAF Champions League prize at the end that keeps CONCACAF happy. You know, they sanction the tournament. They're okay with it because it kind of drives interest in CCL as well. I think kind of everyone's happy and everyone's singing off the same hymn sheet. The leaders of the Costa Rica, of the Central American Confederation are down there, or sub-region. The Caribbean leaders are down there. So, you know, you really end up getting kind of everyone singing off the same hymn sheet for now. That could change. We know that could change. But for the moment, I think kind of everyone's happy with how this is evolving and growing. And in some ways, it's almost a natural progression of club soccer in the region. When you see how much Mexico and MLS are flirting with each other, making eyes at each other, now they're kind of, you know, they're moving to the next step in their relationship. I won't mention what that is for radio audience, but you know how it's going.
Absolutely. John, thanks so much. Find more of his work, The Striker Texas, and Getting CONCACAF. Excellent newsletter on all things CONCACAF. John, thanks for the time.
My pleasure. Talk soon.
Leasing and buying a BMW can be easy at Advantage BMW Midtown. Advantage BMW Midtown will take through the entire process and get you in a 3, 5, or 7 series or SUV. Advantage BMW Midtown has you covered. Sales, service, finance, it can be done so easy. Get that Houston hometown advantage at Advantage BMW Midtown. You always have Glenn here to say, see Steven and Justin. Advantage BMW Midtown, proud sponsors of Soccer Matters here on ESPN 97.5. We'll take a break. Gary Bailey, the former England and Manchester United goalkeeper, he'll join us to talk about Manchester United and more. Matt Peterson in for Glenn. This is Soccer Matters.
This is Ed Tuttle Jones, and you're listening to ESPN 97.5.
You're listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
It's Pico to the end line now, and the left foot gets a cross in. Oh, it's a chance for Dorsey. It's 1-0 Houston Dynamo. Griffin Dorsey sealing off the back post. The Dynamo have taken the lead here in the fifth minute. What a start against the run of play. Griffin Dorsey now top of the box. He's got Darwin Quintero. Here's Quintero. Tries to play in Dorsey. He's onside. It's a second. It's swept in by Fafopiko. The Dynamo are up 2-0. They are on a roll here.
Martin Noble against David De Gea.
Great stuff from Andrew Carlson, our producer. Before we get to Gary Bailey, the former Manchester United and England goalkeeper, a word here for FM Kitchen and Bar. It should be where you go for the best craft cocktails and fresh food. FM Kitchen and Bar has two locations, north of Washington on Shepherd. Get over there and get out on the patio, beer garden area, and indulge in the best burgers, chicken sandwiches, street corn salad, and more. Plenty of monitors to watch the Premier League, Dynamo, and Dash. FM Kitchen and Bar has an incredible brunch as well. Don't forget the new second location for FM Kitchen and Bar. Gary Bailey, former Manchester United goalkeeper, is our guest. Thanks for coming on, Gary.
Hey, Matt, good to be with you and looking forward to chatting some good soccer.
Absolutely. Gary and I have called some NWSL games this year and USL Championship games. And, of course, he's the Manchester United goalkeeper during some great seasons, 1978 to 1987. His last year there was the first season under Sir Alex Ferguson. He's written a few books. He's really a Renaissance man, Gary. During your playing days, I know you studied, you got a BSc in physics, so a Renaissance man, and we're just delighted to have you on the program tonight.
Yeah, great to be with you, and a happy time to Man United fans. It's been 7 years of very average football, and at last, it looks like anyway, with Ronaldo having joined the club, that maybe we've turned the corner and we can start celebrating some big trophies and, you know, the way it used to be under Sir Alex.
Absolutely. Well, part of it is the return of Ronaldo. We'll get to him in a second, but it's fitting you're on because maybe a bit of a goalkeeper controversy, as we would call it here in America. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has David De Gea, has been there a long time. He had the penalty save, but Dean Henderson, he's the homegrown boy. He came in the academy, signed his first contract in 2015, had a great loan spell to Sheffield United. And Solskjaer has opened the door that Henderson's going to compete with De Gea. Do you like the strategy from Solskjaer making an open competition? And if so, do you have one as who should be the starter the remainder of the season?
Look, I think competition's great. A couple of seasons ago, David, after three or four great seasons, started to struggle. At the time, I even suggested to Solskjaer that he has a rest. And he came back and said, no way. He keeps playing, and that bothered me because sometimes you just run out of juice as a player, especially when you're performing at the level De Gea was. Anyway, he kept on playing, struggled, made a few more errors. Dean Henderson had a great season, came back, and now David has to play well. And so Dean Henderson's provided him that sort of that excitement, that rebirth as a player that I thought a good rest could also do. And sometimes as a professional, you just get into a rhythm of just not being as good as you can be because there's no one to push you. Well, now Dean Henderson's pushing him, and as we saw with that penalty save and in general, De Gea is back to his absolute best, and at his best, he is one of the best goalkeepers in the world. So with him at one end and Varane having joined, who I think is just one of the best defenders, so quick, and then Ronaldo at the other end, you know, suddenly we look like a top-class team again. I've no doubt that when we play City and Liverpool, they'll look at the team sheet and go, wow, okay, we've got ourselves a problem today. For the last 7 years, I think they've looked at our team sheet and had a giggle and thought this is going to be no problem. So, you know, I'm feeling pride again in the Man United players, and I'm sure fans all around your part of the world, Houston, and around the rest of the USA are feeling a lot happier.
Ronaldo, obviously a well-taken goal and great leadership, and this was somewhat surprising, his return, and somewhat not surprising. What did you make of his return? Did you hear some rumors before it happened, and what have you seen from him beyond the goals? What has he brought to this United team here at this great start to the season?
Well, he's still one of the best strikers in the world for me, and I know that might not last many years longer, but he's still one of the best, and that's what we needed at United. We bought too many good players, but not good enough. Players who arrived and didn't quite perform. And that's just been most of our lineup. And the best players in the world have gone elsewhere. Now, for the first time, if you're looking at one of the best five players in the world, Ronaldo is one of those. We've got one at our club. PSG have three at their club in Neymar and Mbappe and Messi. So we're still behind other clubs. And that bothers me because United's the biggest club in the world, sports club of any sport. It's the biggest. It's the most popular, makes the most money. But it hasn't been performing anywhere near the level it should be. And we've begun to lose fans, Matt. The honest truth is, you know, 7 years ago, there were United fans and shirts everywhere. In those 7 years, most youngsters sort of becoming EPL fans have picked on City, who've been playing fantastic. Well, Liverpool, they've had a good spell. Now Chelsea, they haven't been coming to United the way they did for the 20 years or 26 years under Sir Alex. So at last, I feel like we can wear those shirts with pride, and maybe now we'll start getting more fans joining the great United Supporters Club.
Well, let's go back to your days there. You were born in Ipswich. You followed your dad back to South Africa, and then you got an opportunity to come back to England. You had a debut with Manchester United. You played well, and that began a 10 or 11-year run. Take us through those early seasons with Manchester United and the nerves you had and the opportunity you had to play for the biggest club in the world.
Look, we're going back a few decades now, to be quite honest, Matt. And football is very different today from what it was there. But even though I was English-born, having been raised in South Africa, I was still seen as a foreigner. And in those days, back in the late 70s, early 80s, there weren't that many foreigners in English football. They didn't like them. You know, they loved the Scots and the Irish. But outside of that, you weren't that welcome unless you were a top, top-class player. We got the first Argentinians in 78 after the World Cup, Ozzy Ardiles and Ricardo Villa joined, and they were like, wow, you know, who are these strange players who play a different type of football? So go in there with a foreign accent, someone who loved the beach as opposed to the wet rain of England, it was a huge culture clash. And I left university to go there. Now, I know in the States, going to university is part of a soccer program, and you're very comfortable with that. In Europe, it doesn't happen. If you go to university, the club will kick you out because they see that as you're not committed, and they have thousands of kids who are committed. So coming from university also was the players in the locker room weren't comfortable with me at all. So yeah, and of course being a goalkeeper, it's the one position where you need maturity. You can be a striker at 17, 18, 19, and long as you score, people love you. As a goalkeeper, you've got to push people around, you've got to tell them where to stand. And back in the day, the big center forwards could hit you, and they were always 6-4. So every time I came for a ball, I got hit. And it was tough. It was a lot tougher than it would be today. A different era of football. And Matt, the biggest thing I look back and feel annoyed about, and I don't blame David De Gea being on £300,000 a week. I'm not even sure I earned £300,000 over my entire 10 years. And so you look at it and go, damn, if I could only have earned some of that money they earn today, a life would have been different. But hey, it was what it was. That was the era. I had 10 great years there, and I've got no complaints. So, I do look back occasionally and grind my teeth when I see reserve team players driving Ferraris. I think the reserve team players now earn relatively, you know, way more than the first team player would have earned in the 1980s. But that's life, Matt, you know, and I still have the pleasure of saying I played for United for 10 years, which is super special.
Gary Bailey, our guest, 375 first-team games for Manchester United between the 70s and 80s. We've called some games, and I've put you on the spot here and there, and I've learned some things about your era that I didn't realize. One of them was you didn't have a proper goalkeeper coach, even at Manchester United. Take us through what a practice would be like when you're at Manchester United in your era when there wasn't an actual goalkeeper coach.
Well, there weren't any coaches other than sort of the head coach and the assistant. There was nobody to help you with anything. Today, when you arrive at big clubs, not only in Europe, but I'm sure it's the same here in MLS and even at the USL level and NWSL, you arrive as someone to sort of, you know, take you around. Certainly at Manchester United, I know there's a liaison, a player liaison person who will help you get your house before you even arrive, your cars, they'll buy them for you, they'll get your kids in school. They try and make the transition as easy as possible. They bring over interpreters to be with you. Back in my day, there was no money. They put you in the cheapest, what they call gigs in England, sort of, you know, with three of us sharing a room. And you were basically told to get on with it. And when I complained, they said, hey, this is England. We dig in and we make it happen. If you don't like it, go back to where you came from. And so they had that bulldog approach that, you know, we have tons of kids desperate to play for United. If you're not up to the challenge, well, say goodbye, pack your bags, and you know we won't miss you. We'll find somebody else. And that was the reality. There were so many good players just waiting for a chance to join United or City or any of the big clubs, Liverpool. And so you just had to battle on. So yeah, I figured out where to stay, what to do. I figured out the differences in culture. Those who have been to England or know English people know that the comedy and laughter and taking the Mickey, as they say, is just part of the culture, and you've got to get used to it, and you've got to toughen up, and that's what I had to do. So I got through it in the end, and then I was one of the jokesters. By the end of it all, I was the one catching all the others with jokes. But when you initially arrive, it's not easy, and it's still to this day for players from America. It's still not easy. And certainly not easy for those who come from Hispanic background, like Brazil and Argentina. Not so much Brazil, that's Portuguese, but you know, Argentina, Chile, those places. To go to Europe and to go to England is not an easy place because the culture is so, so different.
Gary Bailey, our guest, now a soccer commentator, then a Manchester United England goalkeeper. You had the, I guess, bittersweet timing of being behind Peter Shilton, who played till the age of 42 as the number one. What was it like working with him and playing for England?
Look, playing for England was great. The frustrating bit, as you say, was I was behind two of the best of all time in England, Peter Shilton and Ray Clements. And it's a bit like being behind Manuel Neuer in Germany. You know, for 10 years, you don't get a chance. Verstegen's a wonderful goalkeeper at Barcelona. He's only got a handful of appearances. And there's probably other German keepers who haven't even had a chance to play. And it was the same for those who in Italy were behind Gigi Buffon for years. If you're unlucky, I spent 10 years with England and I ended up with two caps. And I did so many tours and traveled, but I had two of the greatest of all time, and they were great. And you learned from them, you studied. I felt that I was close enough to them to maybe get more games, but you know, goalkeepers is a funny position. When you play outfield, the manager will sort of throw you on for 10 minutes at the end, bring on some fresh legs. When you're in goal, they don't change the keeper. If he's a good keeper, they're not going to pull him off for 10 minutes ago and say, go on, Gary, have a run out there. In fact, they do the opposite. But the last thing they want to do is disrupt the defense. So, you know, strikers could get 15, 20, 30 caps and still not be a regular. But as a goalkeeper, you were either the number one or you weren't. And unfortunately, for 10 years, as I say, I got two caps in 1985, just before the World Cup in 86, and that was it, I'm afraid.
Gary Bailey, our guest. Who are some of your favorite modern, current goalkeepers around the world?
Oh, well, I used to cover a lot of Spanish football for BeIN Sports until we lost the rights recently. So I watched a lot of Oblak, who I think is number one in the world. You've never seen a more consistent goalkeeper than Jan Oblak, and he's good in the air, he's strong, he's 6'3". He's just been the consistent, like you can't believe, season after season. Courtois for Real Madrid, brilliant, and Ter Stegen, Barcelona. So those are three of the top keepers in the world. All three are still playing in Spain. Donnarumma of PSG, for his age, what he has achieved for his age is incredible. And I think he could go on to be one of the greatest of all time. But then in England, you know, De Gea, we've mentioned, Alisson at Liverpool. I hate to give Liverpool any credit because we don't like them. But to be fair, he's a very good keeper, as is Edison at Manchester City. So, yeah, there's a host of good keepers. And one thing about the States, we've produced a lot of goalkeepers here in the USA that have gone on to make it overseas. Tim Howard, of course, was at United for a long time. And the good hands that you get with basketball make for top-class keepers. And, of course, Zach Steffen at Manchester City is there as well. So if there's one area in which I think the USA can compete, is certainly in the arena of goalkeepers. And maybe we'll start to see a few more of them playing at the very top level in the next few years.
All right, now shifting gears to your career, you, after playing, went to South Africa 25 years as an analyst with Supersport. And then lately in the States, you mentioned with BN, you've worked some NWSL and USL Championship. And, of course, Univision even with Liga MX. So talk about that transition. You saw the game from the back of the field. Now you're watching it from high above the field with a TV view. And how has this transition gone? And how do you like talking with the coaches and preparing and getting ready for these broadcasts?
Yeah, I love it. It keeps me close to the game. Look, we didn't make enough money back in the day to retire forever, which is what the current players can do. Then they should never have to work again. We didn't make that. We made a nice bit of money, but you know, it would run out after a while. So, and I knew it would, which is why I went to university. And I knew I'd have to get into some form of business. And I tried certain areas of business, and I kept my hand in a TV, and I just loved TV and radio. So I eventually decided, you know what, forget business in general. Let me focus on TV. And as you said, I had 25 wonderful years in South Africa as the main anchor for a TV station that broadcasts to every country in Africa, 50-odd countries. So it was, and it was just great fun. You get to watch what goes on. You get to, as you say, talk to managers, hear the thinking. It keeps you in the game. And then when you commentate, it's almost like playing the game. I don't know how you feel when you commentate. We've worked together, and I just feel like I've played a game. I haven't got injured. I haven't had to run too hard. And I haven't generally made any errors, because trust me, as a goalkeeper, every game, the first thing you ask yourself is, did I screw up today or not? And that's why I enjoy being in the media, because I get to love staying close to soccer and without the very difficult stresses of being a goalkeeper at a club like United, where you're constantly under the microscope. You know, nobody's come up to me in my broadcast and said, oh, you've had a terrible broadcast. I might not have had a great broadcast, but you know, most people go, yeah, whatever. He knows something and he makes sense and he has fun. As a goalkeeper, you don't get away with just, yeah, you were okay. You either did everything perfectly, or if you made one mistake, the press are onto you, the players are onto you. So, yeah, you know, preparing for a life after football is so important, you know, for players who don't make a fortune out of the game. And most people think players do. And I don't know if this applies to American sports as well, but there's a whole bunch of other divisions outside of the top division. And USL, for example, is one of them here in America. But you don't make that much money. You can retire at 32 having not put anything aside, and now you have to find a new job at 32, which is not easy at all. So, you know, yes, there are those sportsmen who and sportswomen who retire with a ton of money, but that's probably only 10, maximum 10% of the soccer-playing professionals. The rest all have to find jobs when they retire.
Last one for you, a quick one as we're going up upon a break. Mark Noble brought off the bench by David Moyes Cole to take a penalty. Do you ever like that decision? England did it in the Euros. Moyes tried it with Noble. What do you think of that choice?
Look, it's easy afterwards to say it's not a good idea. But I do think coming on without a touch is very difficult. A penalty is so much about feel. It's about, you know, knowing just where to put it. You don't want to put it too wide because you hit the post. You don't want to put it too close to keep it or make a save. That means you have to have knocked the ball around for 20, 25 minutes beforehand to have a feel of the ball. So I think it was a wrong decision, but it's very easy to say afterwards. I don't think you should change players just for penalty kicks. Goalkeepers are a little bit different. Bringing on a goalkeeper is a psychological move. That can be to scare the person taking the penalty kick. They think, oh, he's changed the goalkeeper. Oh, and maybe he's prepped for the goalkeeper beforehand, and then a different goalkeeper comes on. He hasn't prepped, and now he's panicking. The person taking the penalty kick, to me, has to be someone who's been in the game for a while and has the feel of the ball. So, unfortunately, for Mark Noble, it was a crucial moment at the very end of the game, and it's a tough one for Noble, but it's a great moment for David De Gea, and that's what makes that's all my focus is all about, Matt, is our goalkeeper pulled us out and won us 3 points.
You may not have known this. 40 in a row were scored against De Gea before that save.
40? You're kidding me.
40 in a row in the Premier League.
Wow. Okay, so he hasn't been that good at penalty saves then.
He was due.
Wow. It's crazy because, you know, goalkeepers should save one in five, 20%-ish. So if he had 40 taken against him, what is that, 8 saves he should have made? And you're saying he didn't make any. Oh, good stat, Matt.
I read it somewhere, one of the English papers. Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining us. Keep up the great work on the NWSL, USL Championship, BN, and, of course, Liga MX. Thanks for joining us, Gary.
Pleasure, Matt. Always good to talk to you.
All right. After the break, we'll come back. Tab Ramos, head coach of the Houston Dynamo after their 3-2 win over FC Dallas. Still to come, Diego Bocanegra, head coach of Houston Women's Soccer. Matt Peterson in for Glenn. This is Soccer Matters.
ESPN 97.5.